I'm Marty Moscoe. Welcome to Radio Times. The United States is a religious country. Look at what's inscribed on our money, how the House and Senate begin their sessions with a prayer, how presidents end their speeches with some version of God Bless America. Our guest Kevin Cruz says it wasn't always this way. In his new book, One Nation Under God, he goes back to the 1930s when business and religious leaders joined forces to oppose FDR's New Deal and promote, quote, freedom under God. They had their greatest successes in the 1950s, when Eisenhower became president. Under God was added to the Pledge of Allegiance. In God We Trust became the country's motto. The National Prayer Breakfast became the norm, and church attendance soared during that decade. Kevin Cruz is a professor of history at Princeton University and joins us on Radio Times. And nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me.
Your book begins with a meeting of the National Association of Manufacturers. It's December 1940. What happens at this meeting?
Well, at this meeting, industrialists finally come public with what had been a growing movement inside their ranks. And that was a desire to enlist ministers to make the case for free enterprise. They've been trying for years before this to push back against the New Deal state, which had empowered government regulation of their businesses, and perhaps more threatening for them, had empowered labor unions for their own employees to protest. And they've been looking for a way to push back against the power of the New Deal, and they've been spending millions of dollars in vain on these broad public campaigns, preaching the merits and the wonders of big business. The problem is, in the Great Depression, very few people are willing to hear that. They see this propaganda as propaganda. There's a group called the American Liberty League. It's heavily financed by DuPont and General Motors. And everyone knows it's preaching for DuPont and General Motors. Jim Farley, the head of the Democratic Party, says they ought to call the American Liberty League the American Cellophane League, because number one, it's a DuPont product, and number two, you can see right through it. So as people dismiss this business propaganda, the businessmen look for a new way to make their case, and they decide they need to outsource it to ministers. And so at that meeting in 1940, the head of the National Association of Manufacturers comes out and says, we've got to underscore the religious foundations of business, and that's the way we're going to convince the public.
In fact, you quote him, H.W. Prentice. He says, the only antidote to the virus of collectivism is a revival of American patriotism and religious faith, just to underscore what you just said.
That's right. That's right.
And was the idea that because of the Depression, that capitalism was blamed for the financial and economic crisis of the country, and of course, FDR stepped in a way with the New Deal, people turned to the government instead of business or maybe even religion for help?
That's right. That's right. The business felt badly maligned. They felt like they were unfairly blamed for the Depression. They didn't think it was their fault. They thought that the New Deal was interfering with their business unfairly, and they needed to win the public back. And so they, and in a way, they steal a page from Franklin Roosevelt. Roosevelt had enlisted religion to help sell the New Deal. You know, in his first inaugural address, he talks about the money changers being driven from the temple. He makes so many references to scripture in that first inaugural address, in fact, that the National Bible Press runs a chart with his speech and all the pieces of scripture that he invokes in it. So in a lot of ways, business was trying to follow his lead here by enlisting religion to make the case for unfettered free enterprise.
Well, there are a number of people in this book that, frankly, I had never heard of, including a Reverend James W. Fifield. He founded something called the Spiritual Mobilization. Now, this goes back to the 1930s. You describe him as theologically liberal and politically conservative. What should we know about Fifield?
Well, that's, I think, the perfect way to think about him. He's not a fundamentalist by any means. He had no patience for people who relied on a literal reading of the Bible. He says reading the Bible is like eating fish. We take the bones out to enjoy the meat. All parts are not of equal value. So that lets him disregard the hundreds of passages in the New Testament about caring for the poor or the dangers of wealth. And instead, he takes a view that Christianity and capitalism are soulmates. And therefore, he is very politically conservative. He sees the New Deal as a threat to both those institutions. And he popularizes a movement I talk about in the book called Christian libertarianism.
And by Christian libertarianism, what do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, they took classic libertarianism is one that has very few religious overtones. And so they took almost literally the writings of Hayek and von Mises and other libertarian thinkers, writings that had had no religious emphasis, and they either get those writings into the hands of ministers and religious believers. They're selling copies of The Road to Serfdom through this national organization. Or they take those libertarian arguments and they put a religious spin on them. They make libertarianism out to be the true way of Christ. They say essentially that both Christianity and capitalism are individualistic systems. In both, the individual, Fifield says, rises and falls on his or her own merits. In capitalism, if you're good at business, you make a profit. If you're bad, you fall to the poorhouse. In Christianity, he says, if you're a good Christian, you go to heaven. If you're a bad one, you go to hell. And so the state, if it meddles in either Christianity or capitalism, and he sees them as really one and the same, that is a violation of that divinely prescribed order. It is, he says, a form of pagan statism. So they rally Americans to think about the New Deal's regulation of business as a violation not just of economic liberty, but as religious liberty, too. They're one and the same in their minds.
But did the public buy it? I mean, the public at that time so dependent on some of these New Deal programs to help them survive the Depression.
It resonates with some of the public. They went over large numbers of ministers, about 17,000 ministers, almost, you know, I think about an eighth of the entire population of clergy in the country are active members of this organization. And through these ministers, they're preaching to their flocks. Not all agree. There are still large numbers of Christians and ministers on the left who still see the New Deal as Roosevelt saw it, as essentially implementing Christ's will. The head of the Federal Council of Churches says, you know, the New Deal is just putting into practice the things we've been preaching about for years, of the importance of shelter and security and daily bread. So there are many on the left who oppose this, but this movement on the right gains traction in the 30s and 40s, and it's after World War II, with the new kind of conservative revival, that it really catches fire.
There's another name, a Reverend Abraham you better say his last name for us.
Veraday, I believe.
Veraday. And he ran Goodwill Industries in Seattle. He was interested in organizing prayer breakfast. Tell us about him.
That's right. He winds up leaving Goodwill behind because he believes that that charity corrupts the individual soul. He wants to inspire people to work hard. And so at the same time that Fifield founds that group Spiritual Mobilization in 1935, at that very same time, Fifield is ministering to a different set of millionaires in places like San Francisco and Seattle that are currently at that time rocked by labor crisis. The docks of both those cities are tied up by longshoremen on strike. The entire cities are paralyzed. Veraday is ministering to these worried businessmen. They're holed up in the Pacific Union Club in San Francisco. They're often retreat in the Cascade Mountains in Seattle. And he tells them essentially, stay the course. You're doing God's will. And so through these efforts, he founds a movement of prayer breakfast that start in cities like Seattle and San Francisco, but quickly spread across the country. They take root in Washington, D.C. It's where we get the prayer breakfast groups in the House and the Senate. He helps found those in 1942. And then through that, we get the National Prayer Breakfast in 1953.
What I didn't know, and I do remember seeing the Ten Commandments. It was one of the first movies I ever saw as a little girl. This is 1956. But you also include Cecil B. DeMille as part of this whole sort of effort to combine business and religion to sort of challenge some of the ideas of big government, even the New Deal.
That's right. DeMille is an outspoken opponent of the New Deal state. He hates what the government is doing with business. He resents the meddling of labor unions in Hollywood. He's an active supporter of James Fifield and that group Spiritual Mobilization. They have a major radio program to celebrate this ideology of what they call freedom under God. He helps produce it. But he wants to breathe it into his own work. And so shortly after that, 1952, he announces that he's going to make a movie of the Ten Commandments. He'd actually made one 30 years before, but he wants to revisit it, he says, because the themes in the Ten Commandments are the themes that we're struggling with today. And he uses the language of that group, Spiritual Mobilization, to describe the movie. He says, you know, are we slaves of the state, as Ramses wanted us to be, or are we free souls under God, as Moses desired? So he sets up this epic biblical struggle. And again, one of the biggest movies of all time, certainly the biggest of the 50s, he sets it up as this basic embodiment of this Christian libertarian politics.
In fact, you say there's a long trailer where I guess he is, in a sense, spreading this kind of gospel of libertarian Christianity.
It's fantastic. He appears in the studio and he's kind of working through these giant leather books and these old scrolls with kind of the care of a curator. And he wanted to do that to convey that this was all based in fact. It's a little bit of a problem because in the Bible, Moses disappears between the bulrushes and when he reappears about 30 years later. But he wanted to convey that this story he was telling was the actual truth. There's a great moment where he instructs his group of screenwriters to create this story for him, and he ends the conversation with a line that would be used by Pharaoh in the movie, "So let it be written, gentlemen, so let it be done." He instructs them to go out and create this story for him.
Do you think the audience at that time understood the sort of embedded messages in the Ten Commandments?
I think a little bit. I mean, he does a great job of promoting it, both in that preview film, but also he has a short bit that appears before every showing of the movie, in which he underscores that whole point about the dangers of the state and the need for freedom under God. And of course, he promotes it widely today. We've forgotten about this, but a lot of the Ten Commandment monuments that we currently fight over in contemporary politics were actually constructed as part of a massive PR campaign for the movie. He works with the Fraternal Order of Eagles to construct some 4,000 granite monuments to the Ten Commandments that are dedicated by Charlton Heston and Yul Brynner across the country. So he does a very good job of etching this message literally in stone and putting it out there across the country.
About a minute before our first break here, a name that we will all know, Billy Graham, also part of this movement. Give us, I guess, a quick snapshot of him.
Well, Graham's definitely part of this Christian libertarian movement. In his early years, he is supported by major businessmen. He's preaching such a pro-business message that a London paper calls him the big business evangelist. He talks about how the Garden of Eden will have no labor leaders, no union dues, no snakes, and no disease. It's a very strong message that these Christian libertarians very much like to hear.
In fact, you quote something he says, the rugged individualism that Christ built. That's a quote.
That's right. That's right. Again, not how we often think about Jesus Christ, but this is a message that resonated in the late 40s and early 50s when Graham takes hold.
Because I guess the country's sort of rebuilding from the war effort, the idea of rugged individualism had some kind of resonance at that time?
Well, and conservatism is on the rise. I mean, this is the moment, this is when McCarthy is coming into power. This is when labor politics are on the wane. The passage of the Taft-Hartley Act in 1947, a major blow to labor rights. This kind of spirit of free enterprise is recovered. So what the capitalists and corporate leaders had hoped in the early Depression, they're finally getting after the war.
That's Kevin Cruz. He's a professor of history at Princeton University, author of a new book called One Nation Under God, and it's subtitled How Corporate America Invented Christian America. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We want to know what you think. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. If you're just joining us, Kevin Cruz is our guest. He's a history professor at Princeton University, author of a new book called One Nation Under God, How Corporate America Invented Christian America. We've been talking, or you've been talking, about starting in the 1930s and then into the 40s and then into the 50s, how business and religious leaders teamed up, in a sense, to challenge big government. This all seems to kind of come together when Eisenhower is elected president of the United States. But as you write about him, he wasn't a particularly public or overtly religious person.
Well, he's overtly religious in one way. He invokes a kind of a broad general spirituality. He had never belonged to a specific denomination. His grandfather had been a preacher in the River Brethren. His mother was a Jehovah's Witness. But generally, his family had just kind of been vaguely fundamentalist. So he felt religion deeply in that way. But he never belonged to a specific denomination until after he was inaugurated. He's the only president to ever be baptized while in office. And he picks a faith almost at random. He says, well, I guess I'll be a Presbyterian because my wife Mamie is a Presbyterian, and that makes it easy. So in that sense, he never really hewed to a specific faith, but was very encouraging of religion in general.
I guess what struck me is that so many political leaders these days are so overt about their faith and so public about their faith. It's just interesting to read about Eisenhower and how he expressed his faith.
That's right. And again, it's this broad, vague religion. You know, he has a famous line shortly after he's elected in which he makes the connection between religion and politics in his mind very clear. He says, our form of government makes no sense unless it's founded on a deeply felt religious faith, and I don't care what it is. Now, his critics mock him for that because they think, in the words of Yale Divinity School's William Lee Miller, he says, Eisenhower's a very fervent believer in a very vague religion. But for Eisenhower, that was the point. He knew that the American people could only come together around this religious rhetoric if it was very broadly drawn. It was drawn in a way that could welcome in not just Protestants, as it had always previously been expressed, but Catholics and Jews. He knew that in a country divided along sectarian lines, it had to be this very vague religion.
But did he think the country was in need of some kind of either religious or spiritual renewal or revival?
Absolutely. His campaign in 1952, he says, is going to be one for it's going to be a great crusade. He relies on Billy Graham, his close ally, to provide scripture on the stump. Scotty Rustin of the New York Times says, you know, the Eisenhower campaign reminds him of William Jennings Bryan on the Chautauqua Circuit days. And once he's elected, he sees in the election returns and the landslide he gets, he sees a mandate for a spiritual revival. He says so to Billy Graham. He says, that's why I was elected, to lead this country in spiritual renewal.
Now, In God We Trust has been on coins really through, I guess, post-Civil War. Walk us through that history.
Sure. It gets placed on coins during the Civil War, and it does so because a number of ministers start complaining publicly that the reason the Civil War has come about, they say, is because of the country's original sin, because of its lack of founding as a Christian nation, and they need to correct that. And so they urge Secretary of the Treasury Salmon Chase to do something about this. He decides to put the phrase, "In God We Trust," on coins. It's a phrase that appears in the fourth stanza of the Star-Spangled Banner, and this be our motto, "In God is our trust." And it appears on coins most often after that, not always. It disappears from the nickel for a while. Teddy Roosevelt tries to have it removed because he thinks it's sacrilege. But it becomes a custom, and it stays on coins through the early 20th century. But it's only with the election of Eisenhower that you see this movement to have it put on paper money. And that happens when Congress passes it in 1955, and the first bills start rolling out in 1957.
And did Teddy Roosevelt think it was sacrilegious in a way because you're putting "In God We Trust" on money, on currency?
Exactly. You're mixing God and mammon, he thought. And so, you know, it's not going to do any good. You're not going to convert anyone by seeing this phrase on a coin, he says. And we should not have these two spheres mixed. The problem is he makes an effort to get this taken off, and the public has gotten used to it already. And so he finds that he can't get anything done, and so it stays on there.
And in 1950 whatever, "In God We Trust," was that a Christian God?
that's a great question. All these invocations of God, again, keeping with this idea that Eisenhower was embracing this very vague religion, it's what Yale Law School Dean Eugene Rostow calls in 1961 ceremonial deism. So the God that's invoked is never one that is phrases Jesus Christ. In fact, in 1954, there's an effort to revive this perennial campaign to actually have an amendment to the Constitution added that explicitly recognized the law and authority of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. That goes not very far in Congress. But that same Congress that doesn't want to put that into place very quickly puts "In God We Trust" in 1954 on stamps for the first time, and it puts "Under God" in the Pledge of Allegiance. So it's this broad God. It's what Eugene Rostow calls ceremonial deism. And so, again, it's God vaguely drawn broadly. It's not Jesus Christ. ceremonial. He meant it was just ornamental. And so this is a kind of a fine imposition of God. It's not a violation of the First Amendment, people claim. It's simply a blending of religion and politics as opposed to a blending of church and state. They see a distinction between the two.
Now, under God, as you said, was added to the Pledge of Allegiance. This was back in the 1950s. There was actually a really interesting legal case that went all the way to the Supreme Court involving a young man in Abington, Pennsylvania, going to school there, who objected to having to say, under God.
That's right. That's right. And so under God gets added to the pledge, and it's a fantastic story because this phrase really gains popularity in the 30s and 40s with this Christian libertarian movement of freedom under God, which they opposed to the government. In Eisenhower's hand, he actually switches things around and makes it, in the motto of the first prayer breakfast, government under God. And so then this movement to have under God added to the pledge happens a year later.
A year later, and this was a young man who I'm not sure if he was a person of no faith or just didn't believe, or his family didn't want him to be able to or be forced to, I guess, express his faith in a classroom.
Right. That's Ellery Shimp, and he comes from a family actually of fairly devout Unitarians, and they their objection is actually not to the to the pledge, but to Bible reading, and they were objected to the pledge too. But the case is about Pennsylvania's a program of formal Bible reading. And they object to this, and they take the case all the way to the Supreme Court. And in 1963, the court holds, following a case the previous year about state prayer, they hold that this is unconstitutional.
Which is interesting. I mean, you look the sort of back and forth, I guess, between, faith and politics. And, of course, we're talking about business as well. Is that the Supreme Court did push back on some of these uses of, I guess, religion within the public sphere.
That's right. And as they did so, they wanted to make sure they drew a line. They were very conscious about this. And they constantly said that things like the Pledge of Allegiance, that was fine. Again, they invoke they don't use this term at first. It's one they adopt later on. But they take that general attitude that Eugene Rostow had, that this is ceremonial deism. Mm-hmm. And by that, they meant it's ceremonial. And it doesn't matter. It's ornamental. It's not a violation of the First Amendment. So things like the Pledge of Allegiance with under God in it, things like In God We Trust on coins, they're very specific. They name these in both these decisions. They say those are fine. That is not something that we're talking about here. What we're talking about here is the state coming in and ordering its students effectively in public buildings to engage in religious practices. That, they say, is the line that's been crossed here, and that's the problem.
Do you think, though, that ruling by the Supreme Court has been misinterpreted? Because it seems they're really talking about schools can't force children to read biblical passages or religious passages, but that doesn't mean that children can't do this spontaneously.
That's absolutely right. And they're striking down state-mandated forms of school prayer. So in the 1962 case, Engel v. Vitale, the Board of Regents of New York, the head of the educational system, had literally written a prayer and encouraged local districts to lead their students in this. And that, they say, is a violation because it's state-mandated, in effect. Individual students, as you note, can gather for prayer. They can pray in the schools. The problem is that the media misinterprets this case at the start, and they're putting out headlines, God struck down from the schools, a prayer banned, as if it's all prayer, not this very specific prayer.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Kevin Cruz, our guest in this hour of Radio Times, and we're talking about his new book. It's titled One Nation Under God, How Corporate America Invented Christian America. And we have comments coming in. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be taking phone calls in a couple of minutes as well. And again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Let me read a couple of comments for you. One is, what does your guest think of the Roman Catholic version of faith and economics? He's referring to something like liberation theology, very different from the kind of libertarian Christianity, I guess, that you've been talking about.
Right. Well, I'm a Catholic myself, so I'm that's a theology I'm much more familiar with than the kind of I would say more inventive theology that James Fifield and others are pressing. But it speaks to this issue of both sides have essentially tried to put their religion into practice, both in political and economic forms.
Also, a Facebook comment from Stephen says, is there a relationship between business and the Christian religion? As there is a relationship between business and the Christian religion, how does the misconception of Jewish control of business arise? Did you look at that?
Oh, no, I don't look at that in this book. That's a great question. I think it goes back to this earlier form in which this relationship between Christianity and capitalism is one that is very much done along kind of a starkly Protestant line. And so they look at Catholics and they look at Jews with some suspicion. That fades out by the time that I'm writing the book.
You do also write about the fact that there were some efforts. I think it was Senator Everett Dirksen tried to, I guess, restore God to the classroom. He failed. How come?
Well, he fails. It's interesting. It's a fascinating moment I talk about in the book of this effort to get a constitutional prayer amendment. And it happens right after the Supreme Court cases. First, Frank Becker, a Democratic congressman, a Republican congressman, and then Everett Dirksen, the Republican leader, lead these campaigns for constitutional amendments. And at first, it seems like it's going to pass. In 1963 to 64, it is the most popular thing that Congress has. This is when Congress is debating the Civil Rights Act, and they get more mail on this constitutional prayer amendment than they do on the Civil Rights Act. What happens is these political leaders are pressing it, and they are stunned to find that the opposition isn't made up, as they assume, of a handful of atheists or agnostic or secularist. Instead, religious leaders line up against this amendment, and they make a very powerful case before Congress and then before the public that they don't want the state to be involved in religion, that they think that that is their duty, that if you're a Baptist, you want to raise your children according to the Baptist faith. You don't want this watered-down faith. If you're a Catholic, you want to raise them according to Catholicism, and on. And so they make a case that this should be left up to the individual churches. The state should have no role in this.
Well, interestingly, Senator Dirksen, this was back to 1966, in his argument to, I guess, permit prayer, a school prayer, he says, they teach the little children sex in the schools, they teach them about communism, they teach them about ballet, why not God Almighty?
That's right. That's right. I love that line of why not even ballet.
Even ballet, right.
Well, and this goes, again, back to your point. You can certainly teach about religion. And so if you're going to approach it as any of those other topics to discuss the tenets of Christianity or Judaism or any and all faiths, that's perfectly legal. The court does nothing about that. In fact, they encourage that. What is banned is teachers, principals leading students in state-mandated prayers or Bible verses selected as a devotional exercise. If it's educational, it's fine. If it's actually a religious ceremony, that's where the trouble comes.
Well, and even going back to the founding of this country, there are references to the Creator in our founding documents. This seems like we have always been a religious country and perhaps originally a very Christian country. What about today?
Well, to go back to the founding, so yes, in the Declaration of Independence, there's the reference to rights coming from the Creator. There's the invocation of nature and nature's God. But if you look at the Constitution, none of that is there. The only reference to God in the Constitution, our actual founding document, is in the date. It's made in the year of our Lord, in the style of the time. All the religious references in the Constitution are ones that keep religion and the state at arm's length. There are no religious oaths for office holders. There is no interference by the federal government with the free exercise of religion by its citizens, no establishment of a national church. The founders were quite clear on that. And then we can look at the Treaty of Tripoli a decade later, a treaty created by George Washington, signed by John Adams, perhaps the most religious of our founding fathers, ratified unanimously in a voice vote by a Senate whose members were half-filled with signers of the Constitution. And in it, they say quite explicitly, the government of the United States is in no sense founded on the Christian religion. So there are these religious notes that suffuse the language of the founders. You can look to the founders for invocations of their faith, and it varied from person to person, from Adam, someone very religious, to Tom Paine, an atheist. So they were not anti-religious, but they thought the government that they founded needed to be divorced from religion because in their experience that had only led to trouble.
Why do you think this changed in the 1930s? Was it just sort of a confluence of events, a crisis in the country?
I think that's right. And again, it's all sides to do this. Roosevelt is invoking a religion to support the New Deal. His opponents are invoking it to push back. This is a movement that it really catches fire in the 30s, but in a way it begins back in the early 19th century. Soon after the founding generation, you start to see people suggesting the country really is a Christian nation, or in later phrasing, a Judeo-Christian nation. That's a term that comes about in the mid-20th century. So they start to push this, but it really doesn't catch fire until this moment of economic and political crisis in the Depression and Second World War.
And, of course, you've got rising communism as well, I guess, sort of adding fuel to the fire.
That's right. That's right. And that's a traditional story, is that all this stuff that takes place in the 1950s, under God, added to the pledge, and God we trust becoming the national motto, the national day of prayer, the national prayer breakfast, all these creations that come about in the early 50s. The traditional story, and the one I'd always believed, was that this was all simply a product of the Cold War. That as the United States is gearing up against the godless communists of the Soviet Union, its leaders played up the religious traditions here at home. What I found in this book, though, is that the people behind this movement are worried about communism, but they don't see it coming from Moscow primarily. They're worried about Washington, D.C. They're worried about the New Deal. And so when they talk about the New Deal, it's always creeping socialism. They see the welfare state as a part of a very short spectrum that leads into socialism and then communism. It's all one and the same in their mind.
And we're almost up in a break. Another break. Who are the businesses we're talking about? Can you name some names?
Some major ones. So General Motors, U.S. Steel, Sun Oil, Gulf Oil, E.F. Hutton, Hilton Hotels, Firestone, International Harvester. I mean, major corporations of this era are behind this. Some because they had personal religious beliefs in their leaders, others because they just see it's good business sense.
Well, let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Again, Kevin Cruz is our guest. We're talking about his new book. And again, it's called One Nation Under God, How Corporate America Invented Christian America. And he's a professor of history at Princeton University in their Department of History. And joining us by telephone this morning, you can join us by your telephone as well if you give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email. And I see they're already coming in, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Time. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Just a recap here. How did One Nation Under God become the country's motto? Our guest Kevin Cruz says you have to go back to the 1930s when big business teamed up with religious leaders to challenge FDR's New Deal and the power of big government. And that's what he writes about in his new book called One Nation Under God. And that's what we're talking about on Radio Times. And again, you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY to join the conversation. It seems that I hear President Obama do this. I've heard previous presidents do this, ending speeches and oftentimes important events with some version of God Bless America. When did that begin?
Well, the very first instance, there's a great book called The God Strategy that tracks this. The very first instance, though, is in 1973. It's an inauspicious one. It's Richard Nixon trying to weasel his way out of Watergate. But Reagan really starts this practice in his acceptance speech at the 1980 Republican National Convention. He builds this dramatic moment. He calls for he goes off script. He says it's planned in advance, but the reporters think he's gone off script. And he says, "I'm going to ask you to pray for me." And he closes it with "God bless America." And it's become a standard expectation for all presidents since. I don't think you can find many presidential speeches that don't end with some variation of that now.
In fact, I think if they didn't, there would be some kind of horrified response to that.
Absolutely, absolutely.
As you said, this goes back to Nixon, which he, of course, plays an interesting role because, as you say, he brought worship services to the White House. Meanwhile, this is a man, you know, orchestrated the break or helped to orchestrate or certainly turned a blind eye to the break-in at the Watergate. He had enemies lists. He did wiretapping. Interesting contradictions there.
Absolutely. And so, you know, Nixon had been Eisenhower's vice president. He had literally had a front row seat to a lot of these new developments in the 50s, and he saw that Eisenhower had used them successfully to bring Americans together. The problem is that Nixon is a little more ham-handed with this. He uses it not to kind of unite Americans. He uses it to advance a partisan agenda. So he holds these semi-regular church services literally inside the White House in the East Room with Billy Graham and other conservative preachers presiding over, you know, the preachers are handpicked to be make sure they're conservative. The congregation is usually made up of cabinet officials and congressmen. They're hoping to lobby on certain bills. It's very much an effort to promote the silent majority agenda. And then he holds these events outside, again, with Billy Graham's help, these massive religious rallies, especially in the wake of the invasion of Cambodia, to try to quiet public unrest over the war in Vietnam. He holds this this massive rally at the University of Tennessee, and then this fantastic event I talk about called the Honor America Day on July 4th, 1970, which is a giant religious rally at the Lincoln Memorial, and then an entertainment program led by Bob Hope at the Washington Monument, which is meant, they say again, to bring Americans together, but it's to bring them together behind Nixon's program. And so under Nixon's hands, this religious language that had once united Americans quickly becomes polarized. It becomes identified solely with the right.
I'm looking at a photograph from that Honor America Day, and obviously a very well-attended event.
Absolutely. Yeah, the photos look like the familiar ones we've all seen of the March on Washington, you know, a different patriotic religious gathering with a very different point. But the audiences are significant here, and I think significantly different. It's a meeting of the silent majority here with a handful of hippie protesters on the fringes.
Hmm. Looking at today, I mean, we've been going through the Great Recession, as we call it, not quite a depression. But do you see some parallels to the 1930s?
I do. It's struck me. The courts have recently started to accept some of the things that were talked about only politically in the 30s here. So if you look at the Hobby Lobby decision or this recent tumult in Indiana over the religious liberty law, they're making the same arguments that the people in the book are making in the 1930s, these arguments that corporations can have religious beliefs and therefore they should be exempt from the regulatory state. So politically, that had been going on for decades. The courts had always rejected those arguments before. Now the courts have come around and actually said these are valid.
And I wonder, too, with the it seems like every day there's a new person running for president. But do you also hear this coming from some of the presidential candidates?
Absolutely. It's both left and right. You'll see it in the Democrats as well. Obama did, and I'm sure Hillary Clinton will, too. But it's very pronounced, I think, in the Republican primaries. You can see this this blending of libertarian and Christian identity politics in someone like Ted Cruz, you know, who is very much linked to the Tea Party, but made his announcement at Jerry Falwell's Liberty University. So I think it's very much alive and well.
Do you see, though, the same kind of big business, big corporations signing on in the same kind of way? I mean, it doesn't sound like it's quite as organized as it was back in the 1930s.
No, it's radically different now. And that's the kind of the social conservatism we see now is one that the corporations really fall out in the Eisenhower era. They create this religious language. They think it's going to roll back the New Deal. Eisenhower actually embraces the New Deal. He makes peace with it. He expands it. And so this corporate effort to roll back the New Deal with this language fails. But the language lives on. It has unintended consequences. And so it breathes life into the social conservatism of the religious right. And that, I think, is alive and well today. Corporations today are actually on the other side. If you look again at the religious liberty laws that were floated in Indiana and Arkansas, major corporations came out against them. Walmart, a corporation with a deep evangelical streak in its founding family, the Waltons, came out against the one in Arkansas. And so you're seeing a split here between the corporations and those who are preaching this Christian libertarianism. They don't want it now.
I mean, I think you see that also in this issue of gay marriage, where you see business sort of lining up largely in support of gay marriage.
Absolutely. Well, they recognize that, popular will has shifted on this issue, and they're in business, first and foremost, as capitalists, to make money. They recognize that they need to cater to the desires of their customer, and so they've definitely gone the other way on that issue.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you again. Kevin Crews, our guest in this hour of Radio Times, author of One Nation Under God, How Corporate America Invented Christian America. You can join us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. A comment from Ed, just picking up on what we were talking about, saying if he continues to follow this progression of thought, ties with business, government officials, and religion, what does this landscape look like today?
Well, I think today we're, I guess you could see the trend lines moving in two different directions. One, as I talk about in the epilogue of the book, with every passing year, a new tradition, a new kind of addition is made to this kind of religious language in our politics. It just increases and snowballs. So, again, Reagan adds God Bless America. President George H.W. Bush wraps himself in the flag almost literally with the Pledge of Allegiance, on and on. It continues to grow. At the same time, though, the demographics of the country are starting to change. And so we saw this recently with a poll that showed that the percentage of Christians in America has dropped from, I think, 77% down to 70%. The biggest growing group are the group identified as nuns, N-O-N-E-S. And so what we see there are that demographically, the country is changing. It's still a majority Christian nation, a majority religious nation, but you're starting to see a sign that those who aren't religious count. And there was a pretty important moment when President Obama acknowledged that we are a nation of believers and non-believers. Mm. Simply putting that out there, that it's possible to be an American and not be a believer, that's a radical change from Eisenhower's era. In Eisenhower's day, his preacher says, an atheistic American is a contradiction in terms. You simply can't be one. And now I think we're seeing a drift away from that. This religious language will, I think, still be there for probably the rest of our lifetimes. But we're starting to see a shift in how it's handled and its importance.
Has the United States, from your perspective, ever been a Christian nation? I mean, largely still today, majority Christians. But even going back to its founding, are we a Christian nation?
Well, it depends on what you mean by that. If you mean, did our system of government, was it the intent of the founders or the result of what they did to make this formally a Christian nation? No. They're very clear about that. Again, that Treaty of Tripoli, where they say explicitly, we weren't founded on the Christian faith. The fact that there's no religious oaths for office holders and no establishment of a national religion speaks to their intention. Do you mean, though, are we a nation of Christians? Well, that's always been true. And there's always been a religious strand that's run through our popular and political discourse. And so in that regard, the country does have clear Judeo-Christian sensibilities. Whether that's formally written into the country, though, into the politics, into our government, I think that's a rather different question. What I talk about in the book is I think, the clearest sign that we've come as close to that, with things like Under God added to the pledge and God We Trust becoming a national motto. But on that issue of are we formally, officially a Christian nation, it's one that the founders were very clear that we were not.
Let me get looks like Tina from Chads Ford to join our conversation. Hi, Tina. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
How does your theory square with the fact that we may not have been founded on fundamental Christian values per se, but we were founded on the Christian values of deism, striving toward the perfection as those ascribed to in the Bible, like the apogee of Washington, for example, and that's painted on the ceiling in the Capitol?
Well, again, there are religious notes. There are invocations of faith. But on this fundamental point of, is the Constitution one that prescribes the Christian faith? Is our founding document one that lays down some sort of religious sensibility? It clearly doesn't. It keeps religion and the operations of the state at arm's length. So, again, the founding generation and up to this present day may have been a nation of Christians, but that's a rather different thing than saying that this country is formally and officially a Christian nation.
Tina, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Thomas Jefferson was a deist.
That's right. That's right. And again, to talk about the, Jefferson is somebody who literally cut up his Bible to remove all efforts of the miracles. He is somebody who I don't think fits with our notion today of a devout Christian. He had his own approach to the Bible. They all did. They varied widely on this subject. But on this question of put their personal faith aside, what was the public religion of the country? They were fairly united.
Let me get looks like Bernie from Pensauken to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Bernie. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
Earlier in the program, your guest had said that Eisenhower campaigned on a religious theme. I was in a place called Korea back in 1952, and Eisenhower's I had recently turned 21, and Eisenhower campaigned on getting us out of Korea. And that is why I voted for him. I knew nothing about his religious agenda. Mm-hmm. So how does that square?
It's a good question, Bernie. Thanks for calling in. Kevin Cruz, go ahead.
Well, he does campaign on that pledge to get out of Korea. I'm not saying that everyone who voted for him was voting for him solely on this religious issue, but he saw religion as one of the key things he did. And again, if you look at his early term in office, you know, we talk about FDR's first 100 days being ones in which he famously establishes the New Deal. Eisenhower's first 100 days are ones that are spent really breathing this religion into public life. He presides over the very first National Prayer Breakfast. He holds the very first prayers in a cabinet meeting, on and on. He's doing everything he can to suffuse religion into politics. That was something that he saw as much of a priority, if not more, than getting the country out of Korea.
You write a bit about his upbringing. You mentioned the effect about his mother's religion. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, his grandfather was a minister in the River Brethren. Sort of like the Mennonites. His father maintained that faith. His mother changed faith around. She becomes a Jehovah's Witness when Dwight is eight. But his family had that sort of broad Protestant religiosity. Again, he and his brothers say that, you know, we were all fundamentalists. That was our faith. Belonging to a specific denomination, though, was something that Dwight Eisenhower didn't do until he came into office. And again, February 1st, 1953, in his very first weeks in office, he is baptized at National Presbyterian Church.
Hmm. We have an email from Peggy. She says, I've heard that Bishop William White, who was the chaplain for the Continental Congress and founder of the Episcopal Church, on the first Independence Day parade walked with a rabbi on one arm and a priest on the other. Kevin, did you find that in any of your research?
Oh, I can't speak to that. I'm sorry. I'm a 20th century historian.
I get it. No, fair enough. And what got you interested in this whole thesis?
Well, it's a great question. I originally was going to do a grassroots study of the religious right in the 60s and 70s. I didn't plan on going back this far at all. But as I got into those issues, as I started looking at school prayer, I was down in D.C. in the papers of Hugo Black at the Library of Congress, and he's got 10 giant boxes of mail written into him. And I was stunned to see hundreds, if not thousands, of letters invoke these phrases. Aren't we one nation under God? Doesn't our motto say, in God we trust? If so, how can school prayer be illegal? And I was struck by the power these phrases had, because I'd always bought that line from Eugene Rostow. If you look at the legal and historical literature, they always say this stuff is ceremonial. It doesn't matter. Hmm. What I found in those letters was, it really does matter for ordinary people. So I started pulling up that thread of where do these phrases come from. That took me back to the 50s. That then took me back to the New Deal.
And you mentioned the 60s and 70s. I mean, it's interesting to sort of throw those years into our conversation when you see, you know, the rise of the counterculture, probably a more secular expression, certainly than in the 1950s.
That's right. I mean, you know, Time magazine has that famous cover story, I think it's in 1966, Is God Dead? So there's certainly a pushback of things you wouldn't have seen in the 50s when church attendance, by the end of a decade, hits an all-time high. 69% of Americans say they belong to a church in 1960. That starts to fade away in the 60s, and the counterculture is certainly part of that. At the same time, there still is a vibrant religion on the rise. I like to ask my students, you know, what was the number one, the largest campus group in the 1960s? It was Campus Crusade for Christ. It wasn't the SDS. It wasn't any of these radical groups. It was this very religious group. So the 60s changed things, but not as much as we might otherwise think.
Well, on that note, we have to say goodbye to you. Kevin Cruz, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. He's a professor of history at Princeton University, author of a new book called One Nation Under God, How Corporate America Invented Christian America. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about this program, including how to download a podcast of the show, how to find us on Facebook, how to follow us on Twitter. I'm Marty Moscowain. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.